Here he is with 9 stone 12, 136 pounds as a four-year-old in the Melbourne Cup of 1930. 10,000 pounds sterling that race was worth, and the best stayers in Australia were engaged, but Firelap simply played with them. Aye, it's like he's taking candy from a baby. Firelap wins. Here comes the champion again. There's only one Firelap.
He's a phenomenal galloper. I think the best horse I've ever seen and ever rode.
The Red Terror, the greatest horse in the world.
In 1930, Australia's wonder horse Firelap won 11 races in 11 weeks. Nothing compares with that.
When I entered the enclosure, everybody stood up and clapped and cheered him. As soon as Mr. Telford came out to leg him on, they all booed and hooed him and called him Hungry Harry.
We're going to lose you, and we're going to miss you. Now you can all say goodbye to the conqueror. He's going to discover America. Good luck, Firelap. Australia's with you.
Going to America, Firelap was sent into the most treacherous racing environment that has ever existed.
But Firelap's got it. Come on, Firelap. Firelap, you beauty.
It's a great debut for the Australian beauty, Firelap. One of the handsomest horses ever seen on an American track. A real champion and a new racetrack idol.
I asked Don who was the greatest horse of them all. Man of War, Secretarian. He smiled and said, neither one. I saw Firelap.
And then, at the height of his racing career, Firelap suddenly dies, shrouded in confusion.
The Yanks killed him.
It was comic.
I rang Dad and said, oh, I'm going to Canberra. I said, I'll have a look at Firelap's heart while I'm there. And that's when he said, well, that'll be clever because it's not Firelap's heart, it's draft horses. Well, I just said to him, oh, you're joking.
With all the public interest in Firelap's death, why didn't Bill Nielsen's versions of events come out sooner?
I think that in many ways he kept a low profile because he felt he should have been there earlier. He did feel responsible to some extent.
The more we look into the evidence, Firelap's death is not the mystery that has long been claimed. It is all there and always has been, right there in front of us, in plain sight. I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Firelap, a forensic investigation. Episode 1. This story and investigation is dedicated to the memory of the late Tommy Woodcock, who lived from 1905 to 1985, and Firelap, who lived a short 5 years from 1926 to 1932. Together, Tommy and Firelap formed an endearing, dynamic sporting partnership, unparalleled in horse racing history, ensuring a place in our collective hearts forever. The mighty racehorse Firelap was a hero to the Australian nation and a star in the United States. The thoroughbred champion had overcome a punishing training and racing regime in Australia, winning an unprecedented 37 races in 4 years. In fact, in 1930, he had an astonishing 11 wins in 11 weeks straight. By comparison, there is nothing like this kind of punishing racing regime today, where owners, quite sensibly, keep their champion horses wrapped in cotton wool. Firelap had made his owners wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. Yet, in return for his gallant efforts, Firelap was made to cross the oceans on rickety steamers to the United States, where he was placed in a brutal, ruthless racing environment, where armed guards were common, where races were rigged, and mafia gangsters ran the betting books, making a fortune from underground bootlegging during a teetotaling prohibition on alcohol and gambling, during the most punishing world depression ever experienced, where criminal desperados thought nothing of kidnapping and killing babies of the wealthy for ransom. Firelap arrived into this ruthless atmosphere of callous depression-era criminals where common ethics go south and mob-ruled prohibition profiteers oversee rum runners offloading their rich cargo along the foggy San Mateo Peninsula near the sublime Menlo Park Ranch, Firelap's new lodgings. In short, Firelap travelled the vast distance from one continent to another on rough seas, made long road trips from San Francisco to Mexico and back, suffered a severely broken hoof on the stony, dirt-hard American racetrack, and then won the richest horse race in the world at the Agua Caliente Club just south of the border, only to die an agonizing death 2 weeks later in the arms of his faithful strapper and trainer, Tommy Woodcock. In fact, Farlap died an excruciating, prolonged, agonizing death, shrouded in confusion and ambiguity at the Menlo Park Ranch in the United States. Under Tommy Woodcock's expert care, Farlap was a very fit, healthy horse. There was nothing wrong with him other than a well-healing cracked hoof. He was a young 5-year-old racing thoroughbred in his prime. Farlap was not only a superstar racehorse, he was Tommy Woodcock's pet. Tommy, on the other hand, died peacefully at my family's rural property near Yarrawonga, Australia, looked after by my parents Cliff and Thelma Hinchliffe and my brother Wayne and his partner Robin. Yes, we were close. This podcast is a personal account and a professional forensic investigation. Little did I know when I started out that this journey would lead me on a scientific discovery that would not be easily won. In fact, a discovery that would test me to the limits of my endurance. I was enticed to this investigation partly by an inside account that I grew up with from Tommy Woodcock to our family, that he believed Bill Nielsen, Farlap's vet, in a sleepily drunken and hungover state, had given the precious horse the wrong medicine in the hours before his death.
And I thought to myself, I'll let him round as long as I really could. Then I brought him in the stable, and he done unmerciful little squeal and hemorrhage, and he just dropped dead in front of me. Now, truly speaking, why did that vet leave me there on my own with that horse in terrific pain? And I often thought after, I wonder, you know, up there early in the morning, did he go up, could he mix the wrong medicine up for the horse? This is only just me thought that went through. I don't say it happened or anything, but that, over years, the thought went through my mind. Why was the horse only at a slight temperature and then dying so quick as what he did? So, you know, it often worried me about it, and I've never said anything to people about what I thought or anything else, but I'm telling you just what I think happened to the horse. That may not be right, what I'm telling you, but that's my opinion, what I think happened to him.
Words like this from a man as restrained as Tommy are significant and not to be dismissed. At any rate, my family looked after Tommy so well, he lived happily ambling around the farm with Wayne and Robin, and my parents coming up from the city twice a week, until he died on April 27th, 1985. It was a sad time for us all. Tommy's bond with our family was very strong. As my father Cliff said,
"We did everything that that man ever asked us to do. That was his wish. He wanted to get away from the racing and the press and everything like that and television. If he's going to have to see his life out, that's what he wanted to do."
And then in 2006, Australian scientist Ivan Kempson and his team put Farlap's hide hair, taken from his effigy at the Melbourne Museum, under intense light beam analysis. What they saw shocked them to the core.
We saw this big spike of arsenic, and so that really perked our interest.
This, coupled with a significant interview I unearthed from 1999 that our late, esteemed Australian journalist and filmmaker Peter Luck did with Mary McCann, daughter of the vet Bill Nielsen, told her not long before he died that the famous heart specimen on display at the National Museum was not in fact Farlap's heart. Can you imagine?
And he said, "Well, it's not Farlap's heart, it's draft horses." I just said to him, "Are you joking?" He said, "No, I'm not."
Driven by these accounts, together with the many inconsistencies and contradictions I found in deep research, I have pretty much read every report, book and story ever published about Farlap. I believe this is important when researching, as the inconsistencies, contradictions, the fabrications and truths repeated in these stories makes sense of the jigsaw of real evidence surrounding Farlap's sudden, terrible death. I came to believe that the Australian people have been the unwitting subject of arguably the biggest deception, well, fraud really, in our social, cultural and sports history. The Farlap Heart exhibit is one of the most visited sites at the Australian National Museum. The mighty heart, almost double the size of an average horse, has come to represent attributes of heroism, strength and endurance. The size of the heart is directly attributed to Farlap's amazing qualities. We often hear phrases such as, a heart as big as Farlap's, that are meant as inspiring praise. Over the last 5 years, my Google name search on Farlap throws up references to his gallantry, on average 5 times every week. His feats and praises have become a part of the national vocabulary. What does it mean that school children, international tourists and general enthusiasts have been visiting this revered icon that turns out possibly to be nothing more than a fake? Was this an elaborate hoax designed to cover up the dreadful killing of the nation's most loved heroic horse? My motto is the truth is always more interesting. I realise that there are those who would prefer to defend the hoax, or worse, design even more elaborate mythology so as to deny these findings. This is why I decided that DNA analysis of Farlap's heart was absolutely crucial to establish its authenticity. This was a hard and rocky route to take, dealing with the excruciatingly slow work pace at the National Museum. But today I'm happy that my forensic study and direct on-ground information means that the myths can now be put to rest. While the brutal, heartless and completely unnecessary killing of Farlap is amongst the worst of crimes one can imagine, I'm relieved that justice can finally be served to Farlap and to Tommy Woodcock. As shocking as it is, we are no longer duped by legends and misinformation. At last I can uncover the awful reality of how, why, and by whose hand and orders Farlap was mercilessly sacrificed by a greedy, corrupt gambling trade. I travelled across the United States from San Francisco to Chicago, searching out people and places connected to Farlap. Some passed away leaving family members and memoirs, and some still living. What amazed me though are the incredible larger-than-life people I found that pervade Tommy and Farlap's story. Honestly, you couldn't make up these characters. I found Ed Perry, the former chauffeur of the super wealthy Philip Conn. When Conn died a sudden death, Ed lost no time in moving in on Conn's grieving widow, Suzanne, who was 30 years his senior. Having seduced his vulnerable employer, when the Australians arrived with Farlap at Suzanne's magnificent Menlo Park horse ranch, they assumed Ed was lord of the manor. Not so. Every account I have of this time makes no mention of Suzanne Perry, but the ranch in fact belonged to her. Ed strutted around the bay driving Suzanne's elite, reserved for royalty Duesenberg car around the speakeasies and racetracks. He was known as a reckless gambler and womanizer, who once married to the wealthy Suzanne, swaggered around the ranch, passing himself off as being from an old Pennsylvanian family, but who was in fact the gold digger son of Portuguese immigrants to Canada. Ed had unfettered access to Farlap stables, and from all accounts was easily corruptible where money was concerned. I found the descendants of Clarence Hansen, who gave me their father Jay Hansen's memoir, recalling his family moving to Suzanne Perry's horse ranch.
Well, it was late summer, early fall, when we moved into the apartment above the barn in Menlo Park. We were comfortable there. There was no odor to speak of. It was fine. Helen and I had a good time there. Dad was able to train the horses right there on that fine track. The syndicate got hold of the idea. They were going to try to control the betting on him because they wanted to make some bucks. This was organized crime. It got pretty nasty as time went on. And everybody was aware that the mob was there to make their haul. but the Aussies decided they weren't going to get finagled with it all. The instructions were to get him out of the gate and get him going, and not let anything get close enough to bother him. So he won his race, and they tried to keep things quiet. They didn't want the mob to get to them or to their horse. You know, they were afraid that the mob was going to get a hold of their horse and kill him. They bought bottled water for the horse, because they didn't want him to have water that was poisoned. You know, they were getting pretty careful.
Jay Hansen also recounts his father Clarence's attitude towards Edward Perry, Suzanne Perry's husband.
He was a louse.
I found Bill Nielsen, the horse doctor, who became a vet from field experience alone, who had never formally studied his craft, yet had been given the care of Australia's most cherished thoroughbred, who once in America lived it up, becoming Ed Perry's best buddy, out every night drinking and gambling at the illegal speakeasies and enjoying the lures of the abundant ladies of the night. Ed dropped Bill off at the stable ranch at 3 a.m. each morning, where on occasion Tommy Woodcock would help the legless drunk up the loft stairs to his camp bed. Bill Nielsen not only failed to report that he had dosed Farlap with some kind of medicine on the morning of his death, he quickly buried Farlap's main organs in a metal box on the ranch, making them unavailable for the official autopsy, and from his own confession, sent a draft horse's heart to Australia in place of Farlap's real heart. The question begging to be asked is, why all this deceit from Bill Nielsen?
Most people knew that the guy, he was Farlap's vet, but no one sort of really would have talked to him about what happened with him in the States, etc.
Did you have to coax it out of him?
No, as I said, I think he just sort of later in life, and I was quite friendly with him, and we were just having a cup of tea one day, and you know, the conversation just headed in that direction, and you know, he told me more and more.
I found Harry Una, the San Diego horse trainer, who befriended and unbelievably took a naive Tommy Woodcock to visit the notorious gangster Al Capone in Cook County Jail for afternoon tea, as Tommy described it. I mean, really, who gets to meet Al Capone? Harry Una had unfettered access to Capone, so was most probably a front owner trainer for Capone's horses, a common scheme in those days.
The news to come along was Harry Una, and he said, would you like to come out a night with me? Oh, I said, I'd love to. And he said, all right. He said, I'll take you to meet a friend of mine. I can say I met Al Capone, that's one thing.
I found the Brazilian, a ruthless race fixer and his gang, who based themselves at Agua Caliente in the lead-up to the big race. They saw that Farlap had an injured hoof and didn't think much of his form. Collectively, with their bookie associates, they backed against Farlap to lose the Agua Caliente race and were enraged when they all lost a small fortune all round. I found Pittsburgh mob historian Christian Cipollini.
In April 19th, 1932, Lucky Luciano, Harry Brown, and Meyer Lansky of New York Syndicate were arrested in Chicago meeting with Capone's main men, Paul the Waiter Rica and Rocco Fischetti. So it was an ironic thing. Why were they there? Right around, you know, this time period. I find it interesting that they met, but I also don't find it unusual because, again, this was the horse of the day.
I found the letters of the infuriated research professor, Dr. Carl Meyer, who, being engaged to make the second and official autopsy into Farlap's death, complained of not having access to the heart and all of the organs, of being given a handful of unrefrigerated, putrefying remains. The professor wrote to his father in Germany, grumbling about being dragged into the Farlap affair, saying that these things are political, and intimating that one must take care, and that he delivered the weak, bland, inconclusive verdict of death by colic, making the point of not receiving adequate autopsy material.
I'm being dragged into the case. One must be careful, as these things are very political. The negligible organ sample supplied by the vet Bill Nielsen were too putrefied and insufficient. I fear the Australians are hiding evidence to cover up for poor supervision of Farlap.
Behind the scenes, Dr. Meyer did not stand by his finding of death by colic. I found a relative of Suzanne Whitmore Perry, whose genealogical research on his Whitmore family is worthy of great commendation, but sheds important light on Suzanne and her much younger gold digger husband, Ed Perry. This relative prefers not to be named.
We called her Aunt Suzanne. She and Edward were both terrible drunks. Actually, a lot of the Whitmore family moved from Canton, Illinois to Atherton to work for Suzanne because she had a lot of money and was able to employ them. But many of them also moved back again. She was very hard to work for. Suzanne and Edward always had a lot of staff. Not just one butler, but at least two. When they went out in the car, there was one butler to carry her pet poodle and another to carry her pet chickens. Let's just say she was colorful. Ed Perry was Philip Kahn's chauffeur, Suzanne Perry's husband. When Philip suddenly died in 1920, he left Suzanne $1 million, a huge amount in that time. And then Suzanne married his chauffeur, Ed Perry. He was much younger than her and obviously a gold digger. Ed was a gambling man, and before and even after he married Suzanne, he would frequent the gambling and whorehouses about 90 miles south of Canton with my relative. He followed horse training in Missouri. He was a big poser, getting out and about in his fancy big car.
And then, dare I say, myself, who as an ever-optimistic filmmaker and researcher, relentlessly pursued the National Museum of Australia to authenticate the adored by millions heart icon, suggesting they use the latest groundbreaking next-gen DNA sequencing methods, a process that I have to tell you tested me to the extreme. I was exuberant when, after 2 long years of submitting my research application to the museum, it was approved and they agreed to do the DNA testing. Can you imagine my despair and frustration when another 2 long years later, the testing had not even begun? In fact, 2 deadlines for the testing had come and gone in that time. Psychologically, this was a roller coaster of action and inaction that spread itself over 5 almost unendurable years. I live to tell the tale. Luckily, we found Professor Ludovic Orlando, who at his laboratory in Toulouse, France, is the foremost world expert in harvesting and analysing ancient DNA from the horse.
I guess I cannot really predict how long it's going to take, but I'm pretty sure it's going to take a lot less time than the 4 years you've been waiting.
Dr. Orlando also has an incredible collection of all types of horse genomes.
So the whole thing about next generation sequencing technologies is that they give you a capacity to investigate the whole genetic information in one go, basically, right? So as opposed to simply look at particular places of the genome, now you have the power to unveil the whole thing.
If anyone can find whether this is Farlap's real heart or not, Professor Orlando and his team can. And then, wouldn't you believe it, the museum heart specimens arrived at Professor Orlando's laboratory in January 2020, 2 months before the pandemic COVID-19 hit. So, more delays as the laboratory shuts down. We wait and we wait. And then there is American author and esteemed racing professional Biff Paul Lowry, who sadly I didn't meet before his untimely passing. Over 8 decades have passed since Farlap died. The key players and informants of the time are long since departed. Yet Biff had the curiosity and presence of mind to make groundbreaking interviews with his friend the horse vet, Dr. Jay Hansen, and delivered the most pertinent information yet on what really happened at the Menlo Park Ranch back in 1932. I spoke with Biff's wife, Katie Lowry, in Utah.
Well, they talked all the time about horses, one thing or the other. And then Jay started to tell him about the time when he was a boy and Farlap was at the farm in which his father worked. And so then they got really in depth on that. And Jay told him, Biff, you need to write a book about this. Biff was just intrigued by it. He had never heard some of these things before. And Jay kept pushing him and telling him, you need to write a book. So Biff started doing some more investigation and getting as much info as he could from Jay. But then he started out on his quest to find out more.
Jay's father, Clarence Hansen, it turns out, knew so much about the secretive goings-on behind the closed doors of the Perrys' big house. So it is that I owe a deep debt of gratitude to the late Mr. Biff Lowry, author and lifelong American turf professional from California. Bless you, Biff, for your astute journalism and sharp insight. I also dedicate this to you, the final part of an untold story. Biff Lowry writes about the deceit on the Menlo Ranch property.
We know too well that Ed Perry was not a wealthy California rancher, that virtually everything written about Farlap's unfortunate journey to North America has depicted him to be. Instead, he was, according to Clarence Hansen, a money-grubbing con artist who integrated himself to a millionaire heiress some 30 years older than he. And he much preferred the company, according to Dr. Hansen and his father, of good-looking young girls. Ed Perry had the motive if the price was right and the access to do the unthinkable.
And before this podcast really gets underway, let's put this furphy to rest. Farlap was not killed by tonic containing traces of arsenic. He was a super healthy horse and was not killed by an unknown bacteria or colic from alfalfa grazing. He was killed by one major dose of arsenic used as a poison. Every book, every account, every article I have ever read about Farlap's death details a gamut of theories, hearsay and speculation, often ending with a paragraph like, "Well, I guess we'll never know for sure. It will always remain a mystery." Well, I don't think that's good enough. There has never been any justice for Farlap or for Tommy Woodcock, who from the very beginning and throughout the decades has had the finger of blame pointed firmly in his direction. So in this investigation, I'll end the speculation as to how Farlap died, by whose hand and why. I will take you on the journey with me as I pursue the first complete forensic investigation into this great horse's death. And finally, after all these years, I make a promise to myself and to you that there will be justice, that things will be made right, at last, for Tommy and for Farlap. And for Australia, a country that loved him most, that took him into its hearts as a hero, inspiring successive generations to rise above every challenge, to succeed against the odds, to have a heart as big as Farlap. I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Farlap, a forensic investigation. Technical producer is Richard DiGregorio.